When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In the second part of our 250th episode special, I'm delighted to welcome back my good friend, Paul Sinclair. With the long-awaited documentary Wolflands hitting Amazon Prime 2 weeks ago, Paul joins me to discuss some of the witnesses' encounters, along with some other strange events in a multitude of phenomena. We cover strange deaths, corridors of silence, black shooks, odd lights, and perhaps even a ghost or two. Make sure you type Wolflands, which is two separate words, into Prime to download the film, or you can also click the link that I've provided in this week's show notes. But as always, before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes. A big thank you to my latest patron, Bri, for joining the fun, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and Mysteries and Monsters. I'll be launching it on Apple Podcasts soon as well, so if you prefer to use their system, then just hold on, and that should be with you within the next couple of weeks as well. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Our intro and outro music are provided by the incredible Weary Pines. And you can find links to their work in the show notes as well. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's welcome back Paul Sinclair as he basks in the glory of the wonderful documentary, Wolflands. On the second part of my episode 250 celebration, who better to join me than another of my most popular guests? With the release of his highly anticipated Wolflands documentary landing on Amazon Prime, to say Paul Sinclair currently feels like he's in the middle of a whirlwind would be an understatement. Paul, welcome.
Paul, thank you. Always great to be back talking to you. I mean, it's not just a podcast. I mean, we're friends. We've become friends through the subject and through your podcast, essentially, I would think. But, you know, now we've sort of met face to face. We share a lot of common interests, obviously interest in the unexplained. Mm-hmm. Great to be here, Paul. Thank you.
Absolutely. I am proud as punch, Paul, to you and Les and everybody else involved in this, because I know it's been a long time coming, but seeing the final cut of it that was released, because as soon as you did your announcement last Sunday, I stayed with you until you'd all done and dusted, and then I was straight on Prime downloading it. I would imagine it's great at the moment, but the biggest feeling or emotions you're probably all going through is a bit of relief because you're finally out there now. Because I would imagine you were probably getting fed up of people asking you, when's it coming?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think I'm partly to blame for that, not Les, by saying like, yo, we're almost there, we're almost there. And, you know, I genuinely thought we were. And Les has never done anything on this scale before. You know, Les is proficient with cameras and he's done plenty of filming, but mainly for bands, you know, for events, for promotional videos and filming weddings and things. And to take some of this magnitude on, it's just under an hour and a half, and it's a proper film, you know, with all accompanying music. It's been mammoth, and I'm just glad it's there at the moment. Excuse me. The reaction, the response we've got from it has been really favourable. And, you know, it's not always going to be like that. It can't be to everybody's tastes. I realise that. And I'm not playing it down. I think it's an absolutely incredible film. I love it. But, yeah, really favourable. I think we've got probably 30 reviews at the moment in last week, and they're all kind of glowing. And I will know some of these people, but by and large, I don't know any at all of them. I mean, I did notice the other day that we'd got some comments, and I don't know if it's going to turn into a review, but on social media, by quite a few of the American researchers saying how good they thought Wolflands was, you know. And that's nice, because, you know, there's a lot of the cryptid type documentaries come from America. Yeah. You know, obviously they've got more land mass, and I think it's first big one that's ever come from UK, if that's the word to call it. You know, it's not some kind of fringe 30-minute stab in the dark documentary about something that could exist. We've tried to establish that whatever these people are seeing and experiencing, it's real. Mm. It's out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose as well, Paul, it's taken 3 years in gestation to getting it all done because of the amount of filming, location work that you've done, getting witnesses to agree to come on camera. You've had to deal with all that. I would imagine there's been reshoots and changes to the positioning of it. I suppose both yourself and Les, you've experience in working in this field, but certainly not to this extent. I would imagine sometimes it felt like a millstone around your necks because of how long it was taking. But having watched the final product, Paul, I think you should all be very proud of everything that you've done, from the location work to the witnesses to the incredible soundtrack from your daughter and her partner and other people that are involved. This is a wonderful piece of work, Paul.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that. And I think anybody who knows me, who's heard me on podcasts and heard our own Truth Proof podcast, half the time I forget to promote my own books and my own work. And so it feels a bit awkward sometimes, just self-praise. But I do believe that Wolflands is really good. And I don't think there's anything better being made in UK. And I stand by what I'm saying. I really do think it's that good. The music, yeah, Mick Park, Nick Britton, my daughter Jessica, and her husband Nick, I think they've worked tirelessly. The poem that's in the film, if anybody's heard it, you know, towards the end, that was Mick Park's idea. Mm. So he'd listened to a few, not podcasts, but pieces of literature and things on the internet, and said, you know, to get some kind of profound poem might be fitting at the end. And so I wrote it and obviously said the poem on the film, and I really think it works. I think it's, I like that part at film best, if I'm being truthful. But everything else, you know, obviously Les has done all the editing. I've sat there at other end of screen, remoted in, telling him what I want and how I want it. But all the narration, I've narrated everything all the way through it, you know, and it's just evolved. That's all it's done, Paul. It's just evolved. And those witnesses are absolutely incredible. What wonderful people. First to place their trust in us.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest thing. Sorry about the seagulls, people. I'm sat in my little office here in Bridlington, in the town, fishing town, and we're all happy to be pinching everybody's fish and chips on seafront, and I'm not far from seafront. Yeah, the witnesses are just amazing, Paul. And I've not heard from a few of them, as I've said before, for 18 months, 2 years. And obviously they've been waiting for film, and probably waiting a little bit tentatively, a few of them, because they don't know what light I'm going to paint them in. Even, you know, we all put us trust in people. I think it's happened before in documentaries where, with Best Will in World, somebody's participated in a documentary, UFO related, ghost related, thinking that you've been serious and you're going to get taken serious. And then when it comes out, you made a mockery of.
Yeah.
The editing's twisted it so that, do you know what I mean? It's just not it's not the direction you thought it were going to go.
Mm.
And that's a big danger. And that's why I've been asked to participate in a few documentaries myself in the last 12 months or so. And I've declined because you just don't know what direction it's going to take. With Best Will in World, people can tell you anything, and it's the end result that counts. And I don't want to be, my objective right from start was to paint these pictures of these witnesses in the best light possible, if I believed what they were telling me was the truth. And that, I think that's what we've done. We've tried anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think when you look from the outside in, Paul, I, through the relationship we've built over the years, I know that you are a man of your word. You're very humble. You're very honest. And you're not the kind of person who likes to spin yarns or misinterpret what people do for your own benefit, Paul. That's what's always stood you in good stead in my book. And I've always thought highly of the way you work and the way you treat people. So I suppose when you have people telling you that they've had such strange experiences, everything you've just said is absolutely spot on, because I'm aware over the years, Paul, the amount of people who feel like they've been stitched up when they've done things like this, or they've had their account redesigned to fix a certain narrative, and so it's not what they actually experienced, it's more what the person wants us to believe. So I suppose everything else that's gone on in this film, with what, and let's not forget, this has been done all the way through the plague that we've had to deal with for the last 3 years as well, Paul. So you would, it's all right going to do locations and stuff, but there were bits where we couldn't meet anybody outside of his own home for a while, and you were still trying to pull this film together throughout all that and stopping and starting. So 3 years is 3 years. I think because it's an independent production, you've never undertaken anything like this. You've had all the issues with COVID. You've had to reshoot some stuff. I think if you'd have tried to do it quicker, you would probably have not have ended up with a body of work as good as it is, because everything you've just said comes across in the film. It's straightforward. It's honest. There's no illusions of strange things. You're not telling us this is what I think. You're just letting these people tell their experiences. And therefore, as you say, they've 100% put their trust in you to tell their story. And you have.
Well, thank you. I like to think that we have. You know, whilst in one of the woodland stroke forests on a night vigil with the witness, Les and Chris Wright, and Chris has been an integral part of film, is just with locations and his knowledge of North Yorkshire forests and moors. Les and Chris heard a big growl. They were away from us. They were probably about 40 yards away from us while we were filming, and I were talking to a witness, and Les came across during the filming and said, we've just heard the biggest growl, but We didn't ham it up or add a big growl to the footage just to kid people. It was just the truth of what we'd heard or what they'd heard. Mm. You know, you watch a lot of documentaries and some of them are very good, but they sort of leave you on a break where there's something incredible happened. And after the commercial break, you come back and they've probably knocked a bottle of pop over or something. Nothing incredible has happened.
Yeah.
I think Wolfland, it starts off relatively tame and slowly builds and builds. I mean, these people are genuinely frightened to go back in forest. Mm. And I've not experienced what they've seen. And it must have been the most terrifying thing. I mean, we've seen something at Bempton, myself and Andy Ramsden, years ago, back in 2016/17, that were a bit unnerving. It really frightened Andy at the time. I were probably a little bit too foolhardy, but I don't mean I were taking it lightly, but I sort of walked towards whatever it was. But it's an incredible subject. And we've started the next one.
Yes.
And we've got a working title, obviously, a simplified Wolflands 2, but it won't be Wolflands 2 because now I've since got reports more in an urban setting as well. Hmm. So we do have more reports from those forests. One's from Wycombe Forest, which is, they're only separated by name, Paul. You know, you've got Broxer, you've got Dalby, you've got Harwood Dale.
Yeah.
If you look at a map, they're all together. Hmm. There's just different names separating them. And Wycombe Forest had an incredible sighting by a guy who's a teacher's bushcraft and a group of friends that spent the night in the forest. And subsequently, we've already been in with them and filmed, and we're off in again. And they've had this strange experience. But equally so, we've got people who are having their experiences like this in their own homes. So there just seems no end to it. Quite what it is that we're dealing with, I don't know. As we know, the phenomena's got many faces. And although I can't say with any certainty, I'm leaning to the idea that it's one encompassing phenomena that's presenting as many things. It just seems strange that, you know, if the people who want to look at UFOs and the structured craft and go to locations perhaps where they think they're going to see them, that's what they tend to see. I don't mean always. You know, people wanted to see the light forms. They're seeing them. So is it presenting as what we want? They're all theories and ideas that we just have to throw out there. It don't mean that necessarily that I'm right, but I think only by putting these thoughts out there and seeing how they bounce back from other people, are we going to get any answers? As I said, too many people just covet the information and sit on it and as though they've got the holy grail of something, but and never share it, which is stupid. We've got to get it out there. Everybody's got to be able to listen to what other people are seeing and experiencing and compare it to their own. Because ultimately, I think every one of us that's listening to this today, unless you're listening and you've just come across it by accident, in which case, if that's the case, stay with it. You might find something that interests you. But, you know, we're all looking for answers, all of us. And I think that Joe Public, and I'm no different, I'm a member of the public, might just have something to say, just something to add that fits a piece of your puzzle that you're trying to find an answer to.
Well, I think as well, Paul, it would have been very easy to make it fire out and push an agenda. This is the thing that strikes me about this particular documentary, is you're not telling us what these people are experiencing, you're just letting them tell their stories. There are numerous variations on it. The mountain biker story, I find incredible, because it doesn't. This is the other aspect of all this. All these people have had similar yet different experiences. They've been wild camping. They've been walking. They've been driving. They've been on bikes. They've been working, Paul.
Yeah.
And they've all had a variety of encounters that seem similar, but in all very different scenarios. So was that a deliberate decision by yourself and Les that you wanted people talking about similar things in very different settings?
No, I think it just came like that. But I could see, because let me just say, Les has done an absolutely incredible job. But I also need to say that it's me that takes the reports. It's me that speaks to the witnesses. It's me that nurtures the wrong word, but it's me that spends time with them trying to get the best out of these accounts.
Yeah.
And it were never my objective. I could just see the similarities, Paul, and the locational keys as well, as in they're seeing things in everything that they were telling me in most instances, the fact that you just said the mountain biker, this thing were paralleling him in the dark, and he is keen to stress that he's familiar with deer and the way that they would zigzag and move, and not really parallel of somebody on a mountain bike down a lonely forest road. And then you've got the other ones where you've got people walking in the woodland and this thing's walking alongside of you a distance away. And every time you stop, it stops. Then you've got the actual movement aspect of it. The fact that the gamekeeper said this thing, when it came out at forest, didn't walk downside at farmhouse. It arrived. Then you go to the cliff tops of Bempton and you've got Jamie and Lee, who saw this thing on the cliff tops. And she said, when it slinked down from its position on the edge of the cliff, it's moved so smoothly, almost cat-like. And there's so many similarities, but so many massive differences as well. And the clifftop ones really puzzle me. You go back into the annals of folklore, and particularly North Yorkshire, you've got stories of these phantom hounds with their huge glowing eyes that really, really have come through. Traveled through time in the form of folklore, but they're still here. But you know, there's just so many similarities, but at the same time, these things are different. It's hard to put a finger on it. You know you're dealing with the same thing. You know, back in, I think it was 120 years ago, in a village called East Ayton, there's a writer there I found it in an obscure bit of writing in Bridlington Free Press archive up in the library. Found loads of stuff up there. They've got lots of old paperwork.
Wow.
And they call him Howard Brearley, and he talked about the bar guest of East Ayton. So you look into what the bar guest is. There's a few interpretations, and it could be German, it could be the bear guest, but it's what is known as a portent of doom. It's a huge dog, huge phantom or spectral hound, the bar guest. It's spoke about on the coastline of Whitby and Ravenscar. But Howard Brearley talks about it in the forests nearby, this huge sort of spectral hound that sort of strikes terror into everyone's hearts. 120 years ago, obviously people before him were documenting things like this. But what I find fascinating is East Ayton is literally 2 or 3 miles from the forests where these people are having their experiences. You know, so nothing's changed. I'm not breaking new ground with this. I'm just reviving it. And I'm hoping that we're going to, by wording it in such a way, we can make it more palatable for people to believe. Because, you know, with these new hearings, the congressional hearings, which you will have more knowledge of than me, no doubt, Paul.
Mm.
But these people that sat there, and you might get some UFO researchers, some who are just mildly interested, saying, well, they didn't tell us anything. They never said anything. There were no proof. But I believe that these men were talking to people who are in a position to ask questions. They're giving their information to people who are in a position to ask questions, which is going to open that door a little bit further. So today, now, we're in a position, I think, where the subject of UFOs is being taken a lot more seriously. What will follow, I hope, is the abduction scenarios and the alien intervention. And I say alien loosely. I don't use the word alien as in visitors from outer space, because I've always believed whatever they are, even if they're from outer space, they're already here.
Yeah.
So, you know, so to the skeptically minded people who say, oh, they can't possibly get here because of the light years involved to sort of travel through these galaxies to get to us. So that's, I've just stamped on your argument there. These people are saying, well, no, you're not stamped on my argument, because they're already here. Whatever these things are, they're already here. They've just got some kind of technology that's far in advance of us, and it's evading everything that we've done to try and detect them. But jumping back to it, you know, these hearings and these meetings and the acceptance of UFOs being real or more acceptable, the net's widening. So the alien abduction, and remember we use the word alien as in just alien to everything we know and understand as being human. They're just different. Those situations, those parts of the conundrum are going to start and be talked about more. Maybe not as openly as the UFO subject, but it will follow. And the subject of cryptids will as well. So the people who are talking about seeing these fur-covered bipedal creatures and it would be like, just like UFOs would be talked about, and you'd get people wearing tinfoil hats and laughing at you.
Yeah.
The subject of cryptid is probably the most fringe of all the unexplained phenomena out there, I would think. But I weren't afraid to take it on, because if you look back through time, even in biblical texts, they're talking about hairy men and fur-covered bipedal beasts, and it's always been there. It's yeah. always been there. So we need to bring this to the forefront of unexplained phenomena and not be afraid to tell the world that, yeah, these things are out there. These people, I believe, are talking and telling their story in a truthful manner. And we need to just show it in the best light possible. Mm-hmm. Sorry for the long way around there, people. I do realize I ramble a little bit, but don't we all?
Hey, that's nothing wrong with that, Paul. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting what's going on. Like you say, I think it is these days now, cryptozoology is certainly the one that's the furthest away from reality for a lot of people.
I would agree, yeah.
But, I mean, cryptozoology, the term itself means the search for unknown animals. And I think a lot of people in the modern era tend to think that it's focused on Bigfoot and Dogman and things like that, whereas it isn't. It uncovers all creatures that are unknown to science. That's what it was initially described to do. This would have covered creatures such as what a lot of people would say the old stories of the Kraken, for example, Paul.
Yeah.
We know that that's the giant squid. But that wasn't filmed in the ocean until 2004. We'd seen dead ones wash up, and people had said that they'd had witness accounts over the years and things that were going on. But, you know, we're talking 20 years ago until we'd actually got proper footage of it. And it happens every couple of years. There'll be an enormous creature, especially in the sea, Paul, discovered. Yeah. You know, like the megamouth shark was caught by accident. They were filming something else and it just turned up, started eating what they were filming. So, yeah, it just amazes me often that people think we've discovered everything, and that applies to all aspects of weird and wonderful things. It applies to nature in general, Paul, because the amount, obviously, the more I've done this show, my continued interest in all aspects of Fortean research, be it cryptozoology, parapsychology, ufology, they've all expanded far more than I ever thought possible, to a point where now I have conversations with people talking about the Fae, or we talk, you know, and speaking with people who have had abduction experiences their entire lives, Paul. Yeah. These are things that I would not have been as open-minded to 5 years ago. So once you open the door and you go in there with the best intentions, yes, you should always treat reports with a bit of skepticism and deal with things not necessarily on face value. There are numerous, numerous examples of how people have been tricked or hoaxed in all aspects of science, Paul, not just the subjects we're talking about. Normal science, they get strange things put forward all the time that people suddenly stop talking about, and then they just all hope it goes away again. So it is a little bit of a frustration, I think, sometimes that people perceive it's only about the strange creatures that people go, oh, can't possibly exist, especially Dogman, because there's nothing possible in the fossil record that could create this living creature. However, the big argument for creatures such as Bigfoot is that we have a genetic lineage of giant apes that were bipedal that lived in various parts all over the world, Paul.
Yeah. Do you know, and I'm kind of in the same camp, or not entirely, I get the feeling that you believe this is an as yet undiscovered flesh and blood creature, which is what it could be, Paul. If it is, then it's got abilities and attributes that a lot of other creatures don't seem to have. From the descriptions that I've got from these witnesses, such as the self-illuminating eyes. I'm not saying that there's no animals or no plant life that does not display bioluminescence. We've got fungus, you've got bioluminescent marine life, and for all I know, there may be mammals that do, but you know, we've got witnesses that have described these things with glowing eyes, with no lights put on them. We've got witnesses that describe their movement as just as though they're on a sliding track, which amazes me. Mm-hmm. Because I don't see that from anything else in the animal kingdom. And when I say we've got witnesses, anybody interested enough or listening to me wants to listen to some podcasts solely devoted to the cryptids, as in the Bigfoot and what people call the Dogman. Incidentally, I think Dogman is just, I think we're just talking about what other people would term as the werewolf. Mm-hmm. But the movements of these things and the attributes that they seem to display, and often a black mist around them, and which is strange, then to me, we're not dealing with your bog standard flesh and blood animal. And just to dwell on the Dogman stroke werewolf, it's not a competition for me. Mm. It's just that if you said to Joe Public, let's assume that you've seen one of these creatures, and you probably wouldn't go shout singing and dancing about it anyway, because it might be so traumatic you might not want to talk. But if you spoke to somebody and said, I've seen a Dogman, and Joe Public would probably just look at you and raise his eyebrows and think, what are you on about?
Mm.
But if you said, I think I've seen a werewolf, regardless of whether they believed you, they'd know exactly what you were on about.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure, and it's not going to sit right with a lot of people, that Dogman is the correct word for these things, I'll be honest. But that's just, we're maybe splitting hairs there, Paul, but that's just my way of looking at it.
Yeah, well, if there's one thing I know about cryptozoology, Paul, is people are always happy to split hairs, so don't worry about that, mate.
Or rabbits.
I mean, you see, I don't know what to think about this, Paul. I certainly don't think it's flesh and blood. I know that. Because, as everything you've said, all the witnesses describe movement and behaviors that are simply unnatural. These are not, yeah, you know, it's almost as if these things are gliding on roller skates. Even they don't seem to be walking. I know the lads who were in the forest, that particular section where you take them back, where they had that weird encounter, the three of them, yeah, where they were basically trapped in that place. And when you, I mean, it's easy for people. This is one of the aspects, I think, of sometimes when you talk about these locations, Paul, especially when we're talking up our neck of the woods, you know, East Yorkshire into North Yorkshire, Paul. People often think that everywhere's fairly rural, you can get everywhere, there's nowhere that's hard to get to. And yet, you only have to look at what goes on the Pennines, the Dales, the Peak District. There are very remote locations. Yeah, you're 20 minutes away from a large town, but you can be somewhere where you're not going to see anybody, and it's hard to get in and it's hard to get out. So
yeah, you're spot on. I mean, you take the North Yorkshire Moors National Park, and yeah, I've said it before, but I think between forest and moorland and interspersed with farms, and obviously there's roads and passing through these areas, and it runs along the cliffs at the coastline. If 525 square miles of forest and moor, and you know those guys you were on about, they descended into a, I think it was a 700 to 800 foot, well, no, it was 700 to 800 foot ravine. And the night they'd only been in it once, and the night that they went into it, because it was just turning dark when they got to the bottom of the ravine, they took a path that they didn't have to take, really steep on the easy path, but they had to get down into it on the backside because it's that steep, and there's the River Derwent running at the through the bottom of it. A lot of things, running water seems to figure in a lot of these sightings as well. And another aspect of it as well is that one of the witnesses, the one that didn't go on film, knew it was there before it was seen.
Yeah.
He told those two men that we're being watched, we have to leave. And you can hear Steve in film saying, well, there's no way. We couldn't get out. We just descended into this ravine. Yeah. It was just about dark. You imagine going up with all your camping gear or whatever you've got up an 800-foot ravine. And we're not talking needing ropes, people, but we're talking, it's very, very steep. And I'll give you an example. We've spent nights and nights in it now. And Les is, I don't know how old Les is, but he was in 65 at the time, 68. And the first time we went in, Les collapsed at the top of the ravine when we came out.
Yeah.
So and he's literally out of it, laid down on his back. He fainted because it was just too much for him. You know, the actual climb out of the ravine. So you're not going to do that in dark in a place that you're not familiar with. They was trapped. They literally were trapped. And then you've got a mile walk back to your car, which is close to a place called Reesty Bank. Reesty, all the place names are amazing. Reesty means kind of rancid and putrid.
Yeah.
So that's a nice name for Reesty Bank. And as I say, and then they're in a forest called Broxer, which if anybody wants to do a little bit of research, there's not tons on internet about it, but the Broxer in some cultures is a shapeshifter, which is fascinating when they see this creature in a forest called Broxer. You know, and then Hackness, which they're very close to Hackness, which is the entrance to the Forge Valley. And Hackness in ancient times used to be called Hachanos, which means with the whiskers. I mean, quite what it means, but it's fascinating nonetheless. And you know, and there's people in these forests. You know, I mean, they're very sparse. There's a few properties that are deep in art at forests, cottages and things. And I've been contacted by two of the people. One of them has asked me several times to go, but he wants me to go on my own. There's no danger involved. The guy seems perfectly normal. He's there with his partner, and he wants to tell me about what he's seen and what he's experienced, as in on several occasions in the years he's lived there, waking up in the night to hear noises in the forest. And remember, he's in the forest, going to his back door and hearing what, and his exact words were, if somebody told you there was a pack of lions in the forest fighting and growling, he says, that's what you would believe. He says, and I've heard this on two occasions. Now, I'm not going to say where property is. I've been once, and it's an harrowing prospect. Yet it also has other properties where the same man, and all these forest roads are padlocked. And if you live in forest, you know, you can use, unless the gate's been left open, you can use, you've got your own key and you can access it and get out on a night, even if you live in the forest, because these are logging roads, the working forests. And, yeah. He talked about standing at one of the forest roads in the early hours of the morning after driving. He'd stopped to open the gate and heard what he could only describe as angelic music. And he phoned his partner and she could hear it. Now, we can instantly, and myself included, I could jump to the fact, think, well, maybe somebody's camping in forest and they're playing angelic music. Do you know, there's that possibility. But he said it were all around him. He said it was almost celestial. He said it sounded amazing. Everything seems kind of linked to something else. The start of the events for the gamekeeper.
Yeah.
And, you know, a few nights before, this sphere of light that just shot up from side of him while he's walking back to this abandoned farmhouse. And I think it was his own words, he says, and things it foretold after that, things happened. And, you know, we've got some incredible, incredible witnesses for the next one. I can't wait to get involved in it, to be honest. Plus, I'm doing work with Chris Turner.
Yeah.
Me and Chris have started work on, we plan on doing quite a few documentaries, to be honest with you. I don't think they're going to be on level, not level, that's the wrong word, on depth of Wolflands, as in there won't be as, there's not going to be as, probably as much detail, but we do plan to go to Ben McDoo. Filmed the big grey man and look into that. I mean, there's lots of theories being put forward that it's some kind of strange echo that people are hearing as they're walking back down from Ben McDoo, and they perceive that they can hear the footsteps, but huge shadows have been seen. There's a word for it. I can't think what it's called off top of my head. That it's some kind of phenomena, as in natural phenomena that people are seeing and experiencing. But for me, for this story of the big grey man to have lasted over hundreds and hundreds of years, I can't wait to get up there. Well, I don't know if you know the Scottish researcher Chris Meek.
Yes.
Yeah, well, Chris knows the area, and Chris is quite familiar with the weather and the terrain and everything else, and he's going to be our guide. We're going to get up there. We might even get up there this year and just film what we can. I was at Rosslyn Chapel 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
And that was an holiday and a bit of research. Mm. And that was quite an experience, because the property we stayed in, never realised, was haunted. I experienced nothing, by the way, but my wife did.
Yeah.
And my daughter, Jessica, did, who never really says out about much. She heard singing on the landing during the night, and Mary got up to use the bathroom and then come back to me. She said she'd seen a shadow pass on landing. Jessica and her husband slept with light on all week in this house. And I was telling Malcolm Robinson, because they had a visitor book in the house, and the visitor book, I don't mean every entry, but lots of entries were, has anyone seen the devil imp in the room? Has anyone, I woke up in the night terrified as the bed was elevating. Another one, I woke up and there's a light on the ceiling and with what looks like a door that's opened, and I can't move in bed. And there's literally lots and lots of entries. And when we went to the chapel and I told the staff where we were staying, they went, oh, have you seen the ghosts? They knew about the property, you know, and, interesting. It were an unexpected bonus to actually go to Rosslyn and see the incredibleness that Rosslyn Chapel is, and then to spend some time in this property as well. It were quite interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, Scotland is a beautiful place. I've fortunately travelled it a few years ago, Paul. I mean, I was there in April. I went to Edinburgh because it was the only part of Scotland I'd not really visited.
Yeah.
And it is, like you were saying about the phenomenon that happens at Ben McAdoo, that people try and explain them away as what's called a Brocken spectre.
Thank you. That's it, yeah.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt you, Paul. You were in full.
No, I couldn't think what they called it, but thanks, Paul, yeah.
Hey, don't be daft. And but I've read lots of those reports. A lot of people are stood still when they hear footsteps. So that gets rid of the echo. Yes, it might be the noise from someone else, but I know a lot of the reports, people also become overawed with this sense of fear for no reason. Yeah. They just feel deeply uncomfortable. They might be stood there, beautiful day, Paul, and then all of a sudden it's like they get enveloped in this bubble of fear, and they've just got to get out, and everybody, they run off. It's very strange, because it is one of those locations that's both stunningly beautiful but also has this weird attachment to it. But there are parts like this. I remember speaking to a gentleman called Graham Milne, Paul, who's a ghost walk guide in Edinburgh. And he told me a very strange story about his honeymoon, that they stopped in a brilliantly named hotel called The Witchery in Edinburgh. And whilst he was there on his honeymoon, he had an encounter with a large black dog in the room they were staying in at 5 in the morning.
Okay.
So much so that he dropped his cup of tea. It frightened him that much. Shocked him.
You would not be expecting to see some kind of spectral hound. And what did he feel? Did he say he felt fear? Obviously it shocked him, but did he, after the initial shock, was it fear or was it somehow comforting, some kind of guardian? What were his thoughts?
It made him feel deeply uncomfortable, Paul. Deeply
right.
Uncomfortable. And he just said it just appeared. He dropped his cup. And then it just disappeared. It just went. But it was a haunted location, as quite a lot of Edinburgh is. But that one in particular also has a reputation. And it was quite interesting, because when you've started covering these things and these reports in Wolflands, I've always been intrigued by the Hexham Heads case, Paul, if you're aware of that.
I am, yeah.
Because one of the strange aspects of all that, regardless of where these heads came from and were they Celtic artifacts that have been discovered? I mean, obviously, once again, as always, somebody says, oh, no, I made them years ago. And then this is one of the few occasions that somebody's gone, go on then, do it. And he did it and they were rubbish.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, clearly not as good as you think you are, mate. But part of all that was that during the initial assessments of them, they were given to an expert in Celtic artifacts, and she took the heads to her home. And while she had them, both her and her daughter had encounters with what they described as a half-man, half-wolf, standing on the landing in their house.
That's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. What do you think that tells us? Is that something that's contained in the heads, in those artifacts, or is it the fact that we've got something to concentrate on, therefore allowing us to access or see these other things, placing enough faith in what we're looking at that it really is special and can produce something unusual? I often wonder, you know, just like with the subject of religion, and is it just a tool to focus our energies, and then we have these perceived, interactions with a god, or you know, I mean, I know we're not a religious podcast, but I just think sometimes these are just tools to focus the mind on a specific thing so that we can actually access that realm or allow that whatever it is we're concentrating into come to us, to exhibit and present to us.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it would always be interesting if you had people from a variety of faiths, Paul. What would they, if they all witnessed the same event, what would it mean to them? Would a Muslim believe it was Allah? Would a Christian believe it was God? Would a Buddhist believe they were being visited by Buddha? I think this is one of those things that we can also look at when it comes to just beliefs in the paranormal and the fortune pull. You know, one person's poltergeist encounter might be another person's abduction experience.
Spot on, yeah.
And I think with the Hexham incident, the weird thing about this is that the two boys, I think the Robson's brothers, their next door neighbour, prior to this woman, who I think her name was Anne Ross, this Celtic artifact expert, prior to that, the next door neighbours of the two boys who found these heads, they claimed that they'd seen a half-man, half-goat in their house, Paul.
Right. Okay.
So we've got two separate witnesses, one who didn't actually have the stones in their property, they were next door to it, and somebody else who was looking after it, both report seeing some kind of half-man, half-creature. But they're both very different, because a goat doesn't look like a wolf.
No, no, obviously no. It's fascinating nonetheless. You know, I think it was February 7th, 2020, one of our daughters, and I apologise if we've done podcasts and I speak about this one again, but she was waiting to move home, and she was staying at ours, and myself and Bob Brown and Gemma went up onto Cliff Tops. And Gemma's not got a lot of interest in this. I wrote night people. All girls have had strange experiences through childhood and what have you, except Gemma for the most part. But sometime during night, Bob and Gemma saw what can only be described as a square of white light on this hillside. They were putting the Gemma put torch on it, asked what it was. Bob said, I think it's a sign on a fence post, then realised there wasn't one there. I'm setting cameras up, looking out to see, well, I can hear this conversation. Then suddenly they become animated because Bob realises it's not, puts the lights on it, torches on it, it's gone. Where am I going with this? Later that night, and I think people will have heard me tell about this before, Gemma was watching TV, we'd gone to bed, me and Mary, and she became aware of a noise like thunder. And she turned the TV down and then realised right behind her, something was growling. Mm. She said, I could feel it inside my body. She said it were absolutely terrifying. Now, we've heard of people talking about the hitchhiker effect, but I believe that something, whether it's these things actually attach or whether it's just as, I think it could be just as simple as a thought. Concentrate, just like we talked about before, the heads being the focus point to bring the phenomena through. Yeah. It could be just the thought of what's been taking place on that hillside. Because let's not forget that, well, we have forgot because I've not painted people a picture of what happened before. In 2019, on February the 7th, those two guys from the military saw what they perceived as a werewolf on that cliff top. A year before to the day.
Yeah.
And you know, we didn't go up there thinking, let's celebrate this. It's the anniversary of them seeing it. The fact is, people, I spend an awful lot of time up there, and that's happened to be the date. I don't know whether it was February the 7th running into the 8th. I can't remember with the military guys now, but a year before to the day, just about. So fascinating. And certain locations as well, just hovering around that for a moment. Certain locations are more prolific within the zone of strangeness, and this particular hill seems to have more than its fair share of unexplained phenomena. And you talked earlier about this bubble of strangeness, and that there's so many attributes to all aspects of unexplained phenomena, Paul, that's the reason we say there's a connection. Everything seems to be connected because they all share, or a lot of them share, should I say, this strange, what I call the lower silence, this strange bubble that you've just described that seems to envelop a witness or a group of witnesses as the phenomena's taking hold. And we've got some. I've got one from July 2nd this year, where a lady called Sally and her husband were called Tim, and the real names. They were on holiday in East Yorkshire, and they decided to visit Bempton. And sort of late evening, not really interested in UFOs or unexplained phenomena. They were just on holiday and they visited Bempton. They described walking down from the RSPB, the bird sanctuary, down to the cliffs, walked on towards the old RAF base. They didn't go on the land, but it parallels the cliffs. So by this time, it's getting late. It's after 10 o'clock at night. It's just starting to turn dark. This is July the 2nd. That's 2023. And they walk back down the path. Now they're not on the cliff top path now. They've just started moving up towards the visitor centre. I know exactly where they are. They've described where they are. She said she's in front of her husband, and for 15 to 20 yards, she suddenly realised that the seabirds people, I need to stress, the seabirds do not switch off on a night.
No.
They're at it cackling and squawking. It's the busiest time of the year for them. They're all breeding. It's one of the biggest gannet colonies in the United Kingdom at Bempton. So that's why they get a lot of bird spotters there. And she said, suddenly, there's no wind, and there was a breeze. There's no seabirds. It's like, her exact words, what it's like, we're walking in a glass tunnel. And we suddenly came out of this invisible glass tunnel, and suddenly we can hear the sea, we can hear the seabirds, and we can feel the breeze. So I turned to Tim and said, tell me I didn't just imagine that. He said, no, you didn't. He said, it was strange, weren't it? So they stopped, turned round and walked back. It had gone. This strange lower silence that they'd been enveloped in had literally gone. So, you know, so Bempton is full of surprises. And it's just another example of the phenomena and its presence in the area and in these areas where other things sort of manifest. You know, Paula, I did one of those shorts that we put on our Truth Proof channel about that.
Yeah.
Just done with a GoPro, you know, rough and ready. It's me just talking as I'm walking along the clifftop paths. And I retold Sally and Tim's encounter. In the comments, if anybody watches this, our YouTube channel and sees the comments. A man responds by saying, I'm a bird spotter and I went to the Bempton Cliffs and he gave me a date. I can't remember the date, but it was the end of July. So, you know, this lady and her husband saw it on July the 2nd. This was the end. Oh, 30th of July. Yeah, 30th of July. And he said, I experienced the same thing. He said, but the only difference was this was between 7 and 7:30 a.m. in the morning. He said there was three other people because there's already people down on the cliff tops. They set off really early. First light, they want to see the birds, the seabirds, and get photographs.
Yeah.
He said, as I walked down the path, he said, and I've just got to this place, and he's describing where the cliff curls back into itself. And that's roughly where these other people were, Sally and Tim. Said, I became aware that everything went silent. Everything stopped. He says, and I thought, that's weird. Carried on walking and came out of it. He says that he didn't go back to see whether it repeated itself. But he did say he watches because he's interested in Bempton and Eastern North Yorkshire. He started watching because I'm talking about strange things on the coast. He said, but he'd have never commented if I hadn't have brought up this quirky story of these other people, you know. So the glass corridor, with perfect analogy that this lady or glass tunnel gave, exists, and now we've got a second witness. It kind of makes me wonder if there's more people out there, and if we've got a little pocket of strangeness that presents this quirky Lower Silence,
yeah,
just in this particular area. Just when one thing crops up that you don't think, you can be surprised by something else, another thing just appears, and you just leaves you full of surprises, Paul.
Mm. And as with anything, Paul, it's one of those things that clearly these things have been going on for a long time until, you know, you haven't discovered this. This has been happening for ages.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And but you've promoted these weird events, these strange sightings, these odd experiences that people are happening. And clearly a lot of other people are having similar experiences. Once again, Paul, different times of the day, different times of the year. As with anything, it's frustratingly irregular, but that's what makes it so enticing, I think, because if it turned up on cue, then I think it would either look detrimental to you because, oh, look, Paul's caught something else. What a surprise. Or you'd just get loads of other people just flocking there all the time, coming to witness what was going on.
You're so right. It wouldn't be unexplained phenomena if we knew when it were if it were predictable. That's the old essence of what we're looking into. It's literally it presents when it wants to present, whatever it is, whether it's a singular all-encompassing phenomena that's presenting and showing many faces, or whether it's many things that are able to manifest in these thin areas, these areas of strangeness. You know, that's the big question, which it is. And I don't suppose it matters that we don't have an answer to that at this present time, that if we can all agree on the fact that yes, strange things are happening. When, you know, we'll get to one day we might get to what exactly is it, and is it one singular thing that's able to produce many types of phenomena, or is it many phenomena? You know, phenomenon. It's difficult, isn't it? And it's difficult to try and separate one from the other, but it definitely doesn't present to order. But because there's such a volume of reports now out there, I have noted that June and July seem quite prolific, you know, and which to me is quite fascinating. I mean, if I can just have a look, Paul, I was looking at 1947, just out of interest, only a few days ago, if I can find this, let's have a look, 1947, simply because of Roswell, I thought, what's happened in Eastern North Yorkshire? And so I looked at 47, and first off, so 1947, you know, we're looking at freak weather conditions in East Yorkshire, by freak, like things that hadn't been recorded for many, many years. But then it kind of started, and Saturday, March 15th, 1947, mystery flares seen off Bempton. Now, what these mystery flares are, what I've come, this is a lot of years ago, as we know, 1947, we're going back well over 50 years, and we're talking about the light forms, what I've called the intelligent light forms.
Yeah.
These spheres of light, because multiple lifeboat agencies are charged to find a boat in distress or a plane that's gone down. They found nothing. And that was kind of, to me, that was the start of the event. A month later, and this is a bit macabre, people, and I think anybody who knows me, who's read the Truth Proof books, knows that I have covered the missing people.
Yeah.
But I do think that too many people do it as a form of entertainment, and I'm mindful of the fact that this is a tragedy, you know, and I'm not going to say that UFOs are responsible or cryptids are responsible. However, I will say that it's highly unusual, the circumstances that some people have gone missing.
Yes.
So this is not missing so much, but this is fascinating. The 17th of May, they found a lady or a woman's body in the South Pier at Bridlington.
Mm.
So, yeah, people fall, people drowned. That's on Saturday, the 17th of May. The same day, 4 miles away, they found dead cattle, bullocks, and I'm not swearing, at the bottom of Silex Bay in Flamborough. They found dead cattle further up the coast as well. That's unusual. So you've got this lady, they didn't ascertain how she'd come to be in the water, but they found this lady the same day that they found the cattle 4 miles away. You know, so then obviously you've got June 24th, you've got the Kenneth Arnold sighting, but we've got the freak weather then in 1947, July 26th, 82 hours of sunshine in 7 days. You know, we've got July was the alleged date of the Roswell incident. If we come to August, and once again, they're all falling on Saturdays. Yeah. August 16th, they find a girl's body floating in Bridlington Bay. 6 days later, they find two men floating in Bridlington Bay. The next day, this is so that took us to the Friday, the August the 22nd, they found the two men. The next day, which would be Saturday, August the 23rd, a little girl vanishes whilst paddling, never found again. just paddling. Lots of strange things. So, although, where am I going with this? Although we're saying that Roswell is the benchmark and the pinnacle of the UFO world as regards where we start, should we say, the era of research, maybe. My little town, my little seaside town in 1947 is having all this strangeness going on as well. And I don't think I'm unique. I think if people started looking, we'd find a lot of these things. The girl that vanished less than a mile apart, 23rd of August, the day the little girl vanished, they find another body in the sea. You know, August was the hottest day in 14 years. Yeah. Another body found. Well, it's not Midsummer Murders, this. This is a little sleepy seaside town. Yeah. There were 8 tragedies from May to October in succession, and no resolve. Nobody seems to know why. And then you look at other places in the world. I mean, you'll have heard of. We're staying UK for a moment, and you'll have heard of the Howden Moor incident, Paul.
Yes, of course.
Of course you have, yeah. March the 24th, what, 1997?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I was probably one of the few people in Sheffield who didn't see what was going on, but it's a very strange case, that, Paul.
It's a fascinating case. It's one that I'd like to revive. I don't mean for our podcast today, or your podcast, because... you've probably more knowledge of it than me, but I still think there's mileage in it. But what I'm saying is 11 days before the Howden Moor incident, at the other side of the world, in the USA, we've got the Phoenix Lights.
Yeah.
March 13th. You know, is it coincidence that we've got these sort of benchmark UFO incidents taking place? Because, you know, I mean, maybe other side of the world, but in the same month. And I think there's lots of examples. I mean, I've just cited a few examples, and a lot of them were tragedies from 1947. But in the same month and around the same time as Roswell, you know, I believe if we looked hard enough that there'll be many, many UFO events. Some of them might not have made the world stage like Roswell, but I think if people went to the archives of their town libraries and different places where you can obtain this literature and paperwork, you will find that when you've got benchmark UFO sightings that have actually made the world stage, if that's not too big a word to put on it, you will find that your town might have had UFO sightings. Your town might have had strange happenings. You know, it really is. I mean, the Westall UFO case in Australia, I think April 6, 1966. Yeah. 1966 were prolific for UFO sightings around eastern North Yorkshire. Yeah. I'm only naming the area where I live because that's the place where I'm primarily doing a lot of the research. I'm throwing it out there because I'm saying people listening to this could probably find similar things. And if we started looking for benchmark UFO cases, the ones that have made it into the books, you'll probably find in your town, in your city, if you look hard enough, that not exact date, not exact time, but on and around those times, there's UFO activity, the strange occurrences. And I think there's there are things that people could be missing and people could be capitalizing on when trying to piece together these parts of the jigsaw.
Absolutely. I mean, the Peak District, I mean, Howden Moor is obviously the thing that caused this to get so much attention at the time, Paul, was firstly the number of witnesses that were phoning the police, what they were describing, the fact that there was a loud explosion heard, and the usual excuses. The RAF said they weren't in the area, and then 2 weeks later they said they were. I mean, this explosion was registered on seismographs that they have in the Peaks.
That's correct, and they can't deny that. And it wasn't, if you correct me if I'm wrong here, it wasn't from deep inside the earth.
No.
It had been detected, so it wasn't some kind of tectonic or activity, was it?
No.
So what was it? Because the RAF had already shot themselves in foot and denied being in area.
Yeah.
I think subsequently, didn't they say that they were in area afterwards? I'm not certain.
Yes. Yeah. 2 weeks after they originally said they didn't know anything about it, they went, oh, well, actually, yeah, we were there.
Yeah, it was, you know, and it kind of made it's difficult, you know. I mean, I know you've got I don't know if you've interviewed him, and I've never really had any dealings with the guy, David Clark.
Yeah,
done a fair bit of research.
Yeah, got to be friends with David over the years. He's a smashing fella.
Yeah, I'm sure he is, and I know he's a friend of Philip's, isn't he? Philip Mantle's, yeah, as well. And he's done a lot of work on that case, and I'm not sure if the narrative that he's come to is it's not UFO related, but I don't know how. Sometimes I don't know how we're going to explain the seismograph information and the overwhelming volume of reports from Joe Public, and the fact that the RAF denied having an operation or military activity on that night, and then subsequently changed their mind. I mean, he may have already done. I haven't read enough about it, so I may have already covered all that and come to the same conclusions. I think something highly unusual took place, to be honest.
Mm. Well, if you ever fancy a trip to my neck of the woods, mate, just give me a shout and I'll come and be your guide for the day.
That would be fabulous. Honestly, that would absolutely be brilliant. And I look forward to it. I don't see why not, because as I say, I'm from South Yorkshire myself, aren't
yes. I? Yeah. Bring you back home, mate. I mean, it is, because like I say, the Peaks, obviously Jenny Randall's done a lot of work on stuff that's occurred over the Peaks over the years. Paul, is, you know, it's classed as yet again another place in the UK that we have a lot of strange things go on. I mean, there's a little village near Matlock called Bonsall,
right,
which has had an extreme history of numerous UFO sightings over that particular small town. So, I mean, it's about, I don't know, it's about 30 miles away from Howden as the crow flies going down. So it's towards the bottom of the Peaks.
Right.
So we've always had strange things, you know. I mean, the thing I saw 12 years ago was heading off towards the Peak District. So this, yeah, we see strange things down here, mate. So anytime you want to come down, I'll be more than happy to chip in and help out and see where I can uncover for you, as well as if you want to come over, I'm sure we'll sort something.
Well, that, you know, I've obviously we're doing the podcast and we've talked about Wolflands and lots of things, but just to touch on the work that I'm going to be doing with Chris Turner, and we're going to cover the Grey Man. The Howden Moor incident could be an interesting one to cover, and you could be a great guy give us a bit of advice on that. But yeah, that's a story for another time, maybe.
Absolutely. Anything I can do to help, my friend, just you know that, just ask. Be nice to host you for a change.
that'd be wonderful. And yeah, look forward to it, Paul.
Mm. I mean, obviously, with all these encounters that people are coming forward to, Paul, about obviously what you've just done with Wolflands and the new project that you've got going, and obviously you're kind of diversifying in regards to some of the phenomenon. Have you had anybody come forward who's kind of reported what we would consider the normal kind of things? Because I know you've had a few stories in the truth books from people who've claimed to have seen the Barghest, or the Shook, as other people may know it. But round our neck of the woods, we call it the Barghest. Because when you go upwards from sort of York onwards, there are... York's got a story about one. Darlington has. There's loads of stories from the North Pennine areas. Out on the coast, Whitby. I think the report you gave that's in one of your books, Paul, somebody saw one on a beach, I believe. It's perplexing for me that we seem to have evolved somehow, or maybe it's, as we've been saying, we've been considering the possibilities of what these things could possibly be. That are these upright bar guests, or is this what it's presenting itself at now? It now wants to be bipedal, whereas all the other reports, very few of them would say about a Barghest or a Shook rearing up, Paul.
On two legs. Yeah, it's a good point. It's almost like the phenomena evolves.
Mm.
It's almost like the shape of the UFOs have evolved over the years, and that we're more acceptable to the fact now that they're not forced to be something that you, nuts and bolts that you can tap on the side. I don't know. This is why... earlier on in what we were talking about, I said, I wonder if we were looking at something that's one singular intelligence that can present as many things. And as we've evolved and adapted our ideas over the years, this thing's changing its face. I really don't know. I'm fascinated by the reports that we get off it from East Yorkshire, which is literally behind me. I'm probably 400 yards from seafront.
Yeah.
So we're not getting them on the seafront at Bridlington, but when you just go out of town and you're up there on Bempton and Speighton, and we're getting reports. And although we've got sparse reports of the phantom hounds and things, we're getting reports of physical looking creatures. And I haven't struggled with the witness who are telling me this, because I believe that they've seen something, but I'm just wondering, are we creating these things? And it might be a far out idea, but it seems to me that the sightings are more prolific now on these cliff tops since I've initially started reporting them. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, and I got a report a few days ago from a guy, second-hand report, to be honest with you, from somebody who used to work at a supermarket, told me about a man who claimed he'd seen what he called a monster close to the Lynx Golf Club at Danesdyke.
Oh.
I've since spoken to the man, and I'm hoping he's going to send me his full report. Spoke to him a few days ago, and this was back in 2007. But what's fascinating, so I'm kind of contradicting myself here, because what's fascinating is that we've got, when you go to Danesdyke, the golf course runs along the sort of eastern edge of it.
Yeah.
But we've got reports of the entrance to Danesdyke, the metal detector, seeing the huge dog with the half human, half dog face. We've got the guy travelling home on his night shift and who sees very close to the edge of the golf course. We've got the guy who was walking in the other side of Danesdyke, the part that the public don't go in much.
Yeah.
And he's waiting for a bus after he's had his walk, and he claims that this huge dog came out of the dike, and its face was half human, half dog. Sparkling eyes as well that he said he had, and he allowed me to record him telling him this account. I've since met him a few times. The same place where he was stood at the bus stop, there's another bus stop at the other side of the road. This is where in the early hours of the morning, and I can't remember the exact date, someone tells me it was 2018, a man coming home from work on a night shift claimed that he saw something, and his exact description was, he said, have you ever seen the werewolf from the American Werewolf in London? Because that's what it looked like on its all fours.
Wow.
So we've got different people, different from different years, different educational backgrounds, different jobs, some just walking and coming home at 5 o'clock after a long walk in the woods, seen these things. And you know, the security guard at the Lynx golf course, a guy called Dean Dealtree, and this would be taking us back to 2014, saying that he ended up doing the perimeter of the golf course one night with his two Staffordshire Bull Terrier dogs and stood in disbelief on edge of golf course, looking into the woodland, looking into the darkness, not daring to go in. And his dogs had no desire to go in. He says because there was something growling and screaming. And he likened it to, you know, when the chimpanzees like throw a display,
yeah,
and they run round breaking branches and hitting trees and getting all animated. He said, that's what it was like. He said, I turned and went back to my flat on the golf course. He said, it was so unnerving. But that's not very far away from where this guy said that he's seen something that he described as a monster. Now, Danes Dyke, anybody who is not familiar with this area, it's a 2.5 mile long Neolithic earthwork that sent to cut Flamborough Head off from the mainland of Bridlington. So we're going back like 4,000 years. It's called Danes Dyke because originally archaeologists and historians thought that the Vikings built it, hence the name Danes Dyke. Then it were excavated, I think, in the later 1800s by a guy called Pitt Rivers. Sounds incredible, doesn't he? Sounds like some movie star, but that's what his name. Yeah, Pitt Rivers
brilliant.
Excavated Danes Dyke or sections of it and found huge quantities of flint tools and other artifacts, which threw it back to a lot earlier period that it was excavated. So we've got, once again, ancient places throwing up these ancient stories. And where am I going with this? Yeah, so Danes Dyke's a landmark area for these sightings, but we've not just got the stories of the what we would call the werewolf in Danes Dyke. You've got the kind of spectral form of the White Lady, where people claim to have seen this apparition of a White Lady floating through the dyke. Now, I've spoken to numerous people who claim to have seen her, and when we actually get to what they've seen, Paul, they've seen a sphere of white light.
Mm.
But once again, it's human interpretation. We're wanting to put it's a ghost. We're wanting to make it what we want it, perceive it to be. You know, on the cliff tops at Bempton, the rock anglers talk about the ghost of big railings. So there's a big stand that looks out to sea, and over the years, they've seen this, what they perceive as a fisherman with a headlight on, up at big railings, and seen him walking down towards them and then disappearing. But they've not seen anybody walking. They've just seen a sphere of light. And they're putting their interpretation on it, that it's a deceased fisherman. Nobody's actually seen the full form of anybody, just a light. So I realise we've gone off all over the place there, Paul, but, you know, I think certain locations are holding the information. And we know that earlier we said, well, if we knew months and we knew when these things were going to occur, you know, everybody would go. But that's the fact, is it wouldn't be unexplained phenomena. But October has proved to be prolific for the sightings of these bipedal-type creatures at Danes Dyke. October the 16th, I think it was, that a delivery driver claims he saw this thing on what's called Dewson Lane. Where's Dewson Lane? It's less than a mile from Danes Dyke. October the 20th, I ain't got this in front of me, but I can remember this. October the 20th, 2020, is when the guy walking the dyke, who said this huge dog with an half-human, half-dog face, came out of the dyke. October the 20th, 2020. So, and I can't remember. I'd be lying if I said I could remember the date of the guy travelling home on nights. But we've got, everything's linked by location. Everything, and things, certain things are linked by date as well. But I think if we could get more people, Paul, to open up, more people to come forward, and I'm hoping Wolflands opens that door a little bit more, then we might actually be able to form some ideas of when these things are likely to occur. I've been trying for years. I've been throwing it out there in podcasts and various radio interviews that people are researching the primary areas in other parts of the world, the Hoya Baku Forest. Trey Hudson, who was doing fabulous work on the Meadow Project. I don't know whether you've interviewed him, have you, Paul?
No. No,
you really should. If you haven't, you really should.
Mm.
You know, a really interesting guy. And the people at Skinwalker, and I said it to George Knapp, and although I know George is probably not as involved in Skinwalker as he was years ago, I don't know extent to what he's involved in at the moment. But they should be cross-referencing, not holding this information as though it's the Holy Grail and that we've researched it, it's our information, we're not sharing it with nobody. It needs cross-referencing because we might all be able to find some answers. You know, what's happening? I mean, the light luminescence under the sea last night, around midnight.
Mm.
You know, are people seeing this? Are people experiencing this month in other parts of the world? You know, it would be fascinating if they were, or as a major thing's happening. But instead, you know, nobody seems to be putting all these parts together, and I've not got enough time to put all these parts together. If people want to help, I'm quite happy to accept help.
Mm.
Or if people want to share and let's cross-pollinate this information and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, you've struck a chord with me there, Paul, because we've got a specific... It's 20 minutes walk from where I live. We've got a street in Sheffield called Bunting Nook, which is a wonderful name. We've got some lovely named streets around here. And it's next to one of our city centre parks, Graves Park, here in Sheffield. Bunting Nook has a reputation, firstly, of a sightings of a strange black dog with glowing eyes. People have claimed they can see saliva dripping out of its fangs, Paul.
Right.
Several reports of that. People have reported seeing a dead man hanging from the trees. There are people who say they've encountered the spirit of a white lady or a mist that appears around them, all right, in that particular area. So why are people seeing different things? Are they seeing that, as we've considered earlier, are they seeing the same thing and it's presenting in different forms? I mean, the witness that told the story about the hanging man was driving past with, I think her son was 7 years old, sat in the back, and he started screaming in the back of the car, and she said, what's the matter? He said, the man's hanging from the tree, and she's looking, she can't see anything, and he only calmed down when they went past. She said there was nothing there, and why would a seven-year-old suddenly start screaming driving down a very quiet road in the middle of the afternoon, Paul?
It's a strange one, isn't it? And why? And why does that particular area throw up all those different type of phenomena? And is it just one thing? I know we're sort of going over things we've spoke about before, as in, is it just one thing presenting as many things? But, you know, I think there's a good chance that it could be.
Mm.
Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Well, we've got two. We've got Bunting Nook, and then there was another encounter. I don't know, 1880, I think it was. Other side. Well, not too far, about three or four miles away, other side of Sheffield, on where the botanical gardens are, near Ecclesall Road in Sheffield, big student area. Guy there, attacked by a giant black dog that vanished into thin air, Paul.
Yeah, it's so strange. Yeah, I have a report from a Flamborough man.
Mm.
Travelling home after a night walking on foot, travelling, he's only in the village of Flamborough, after a night, a few beers in the pub.
Mm.
Not drunk as far as I'm aware, but he talks about seeing the shadow of a huge dog on four legs accompanying him. He can see shadow on the road but can't see the dog.
Mm.
Unusually, he's no fear. He feels like it were a guardian. He felt like it was somehow protecting him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're doing the live stream, our live stream. What day is it today? We're doing our live stream anyway, shortly. And we'll be talking to a guy called Alistair Lavers.
Yeah.
What's fascinating about Alistair is Alistair, years ago, put me in touch with this chap who claimed that he didn't want his name used, and he claimed that he'd been driving home from Scarborough through foxholes back home to Hull,
mm-hmm,
when a huge hound was with massive teeth, he said, fangs as big as his thumbs, was pacing the side of his car. All close to Flixton, this, you know, when we've got the stories of the Flixton werewolf. Well, the chap I'm talking about now, I kept my word and never used his name, and I won't do. If Alistair wants to use it, that's fine.
Yeah.
Because he passed away. He passed away last year.
Mm.
And Alistair's coming on to talk about the occult and other things, but I said, what about the car chaser? What about this amazing story that you told me about? And I did get to speak to it. It weren't a second-hand story. Alistair put me in touch. He goes, yeah, I says, I think we can talk about this. So I'm going to get Alistair to retell the story as well, which is a fascinating one, to be honest. It's a shame that people often take these amazing accounts to the grave. It's is terrible. That and I know it's their choice and their right if that's what they want to do, but just for the fear of ridicule, people decide that they would rather just let these strange stories die, for want of a better word, with them, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think as well, Paul, often when we uncover really odd stories, and there's one in particular I've heard you talk about before. And when I heard you talking about it, I was just perplexed. I couldn't understand what the official explanation was. Now, this happened several years ago. The guy who was found on somebody's drive, Paul, naked.
Oh, yeah. Raymond Johnson.
Now, I don't think we've ever touched on this one, because I've heard you speak about it, but I don't think I've ever picked your brains about it. When we're talking about why people don't come forward or they keep their secrets, here we have an incident that occurs with several witnesses, and then the official narrative does not match what they've described at all, which is one of those things, without wishing to go conspiracies or anything like that, if you see something and then you see a report of what you've allegedly reported or witnessed, and it's completely different, you I would imagine you get a bit scared, Paul, because you think, well, that's not what happened. Why are they saying that? So for anybody who's not heard this story, Paul, can you give me a very brief recap of this really odd story?
It is an odd one, and I haven't got the paperwork in front of me, I'll be as brief as I can. And I think it was 1990 going into 1991. I've written about it in Truth Proof 2. And the newspaper, I found it in the Bridlington Free Press, and the newspaper reported that, I think the what stuck in my mind, it said, "We are not looking to blame anyone. We merely think this is an accident and the person involved may not have known what they'd done." And this was from a detective who's now retired, because I've gone into this quite deep. I was tempted to say his name then, but I've no axe to grind with the person. I mean, you know, he's probably done as thorough a job as he can.
Yeah.
But so basically, Bempton Lane, short lane, the lane I talk about quite a lot in the Truth Proof books, because it's absolutely nondescript, yet there's UFO reports on it, there's big cat sightings on it, there's all manner of things. The entrance to this man was seen running. Short lane comes out, if you picture it, a T, and Bempton Lane would be the top of the T, and short lane intersects it halfway. And the motorists had seen a man running naked up Bempton Lane. In December, it was freezing cold. There was a bit of a blizzard. The ground was frozen hard, and he's running naked up Bempton Lane. And then the newspaper said that they'd found him collapsed at the entrance of a farm. Not true. He'd collapsed probably about 40 yards away under the bathroom window of the farmhouse. So not at the entrance. So that's the first thing that's wrong. Although, you know, it could be that the occupants of the farmhouse wanted it worded that way. But I don't know, because I actually traced them and went and sat talking to them at length years later. So just a little bit of more background. The man at the time who owned the farmhouse was in the bathroom. He said, "Well, I'm sat in the bathroom. Everything's battened down tight." He says, "It's absolutely horrendous. Snow, sleet is terrible." He said, "And I heard this huge crack, massive crack, like you'd slammed a car bonnet down as hard as you could or something." He said, "My daughter was downstairs and she shouted up, 'Dad, did you hear that?'" He said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "It must have been loud because the weather were atrocious. There's no windows open." Says,
yeah.
Short time later, there's some headlights coming onto the up the drive. Hear a car door shut, and then I hear somebody shouting, "Dad, Dad, quick, quick, quick." He says, and I thought, his exact words, I think, "Well, this better be good." He said, I opened the bathroom window and looked out, and there's a man laid under the bathroom window naked. He said, and he made a murmur, so he'd not passed away, bless him. He said, and I'm not going to say extent of it. He'd got some severe head injuries that weren't reported in paper. So he said, I went straight, sorted myself out, went downstairs, took a blanket, put it over him, phoned emergency services and the police. I think he passed away by the time police arrived. I spoke to a police officer involved in it, and police said, "We thought at first he'd been dropped from the air." So, but coming up with logical conclusions, they believed that he'd been hit with a car or a large vehicle with bull bars. And that's what had caused this. I think it was a broken shoulder blade, broken collarbone, severe internal injuries, cracked ribs, massive stomach injuries. And I'll not say about the injuries to his head. The newspaper report said the body, not the man, the body in this condition had stripped its clothes off whilst running up Bempton Lane. It had gone into the body clock had overheated, and he'd gone into this condition where people get, where they feel like they're hot even though they're freezing, and he'd stripped his clothes off. Now, I spoke to some medical professional and saying he'd not the ability to take his clothes off with this broken collarbone and shoulder blade to actually remove clothes. Plus, they're talking about it as a body running, not the man. And they said his clothes then were scattered all the way up Bempton Lane. Wrong. The son of the farmer, or the man at the farmhouse, said when he approached off Short Lane earlier, just a few minutes before, there was a pile of clothing at the bottom of Short Lane. He never saw any clothing strewn all the way up Bempton Lane. I'm not saying that they weren't, but his explanation sounds more plausible. So this guy, Raymond Johnson, they never established what killed him. Well, we know what killed him, massive trauma, but nobody was ever brought to justice for killing him. And the newspaper report literally said, we are not wanting to blame anybody in connection with this tragedy. We merely want them to come forward. They may not even be aware that they've done it. And I think when I wrote about it in Truth Proof 2, Paul, I said, it's almost as though they're talking about it's a rabbit or something. This is a life.
Yeah.
And we're treating it like that. Surely anybody who's hit somebody, it's an hit and run. It's a full-grown human being, regardless of weather conditions, you'd know you'd hit them. So why the wording in the paper was like that, I've no idea. Mm. 1990/91, I think it was, and I don't think they're any closer to an answer now as to the demise of Raymond Johnson than they were back then. There's a lot more in between that I've probably missed, people, but if I'm being truthful, I haven't got that. Any of that paperwork in front of me.
Hey, that's all right, Paul. It was a bit of a curveball I threw at you, and I thought you dealt with that excellently. So thank you for indulging me.
No, it's fine. It's if I can remember the important thing, I think, when we're doing these interviews and when we're talking about these things, is to try not to try and, you know, obviously we've got to get as accurate as you can, but I'm always mindful that if I say a date wrong, you get some expert who sat and listened to another podcast I've done and said, do you realize you said January 20th and you said January 21st in other interview? And it's not because I'm lying, it's probably because I haven't got the paperwork in front of me. And remembering dates that like this, it's not the easiest thing in the world, you know.
Yeah Of course it's not. I mean, I as I was saying earlier, Paul, when I saw My Strange Life, I was convinced that had happened in 2008. And then a couple of years ago, it popped up on my Facebook memories, and it was from 2010.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy, you know. And I've just found a bit of paper. It was December 15th, 1992.
There we are, then.
And found unconscious, this is what I've written, not other people, 5:35 p.m. at the entrance of Alnotset Farm, freezing cold night, naked. He didn't even have socks on, you know. Hit by a off-road. They think he'd been hit by an off-road vehicle, possibly with bull bars. Massive head trauma, broken shoulder blade, severe internal injuries, cracked ribs. So I didn't realise I'd got this to hand. I'll just briefly go through it, people. I don't want to. Let's have a look. Pile of clothes. I'm just seeing if there's anything I've missed. Police did not want to blame anyone, adding that it was purely an accident and whoever did it may not have been aware they had done it. And I put, they hit an adult male. You would think they were talking about running over a rabbit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but even the language of the report is odd, Paul.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I talked about it online briefly years ago. And when I came to turn my computer off, I'd got a message from David Pilates because somebody must have put him onto it and he were interested. But it were early hours at morning and I were working at time and my wife were asleep in bed and I couldn't devote time he wanted me to do at that time in the morning to fill him in on details. And plus, it's other side of the world. I mean, I think if you're going to look into the cases of missing people and all you've got is a newspaper archive, you need some boots on ground where it's actually happening rather than just relying on newspapers. I mean, the guy does a sterling job, by the way. There's no axe to grind with anybody there. But I think if I'm looking into the missing people around Bempton, which I have done, and East Yorkshire, I'm better placed than anybody else in the world who looks into missing people, because I can actually get out there and speak first hand. I can see locations, you know, and there's nothing better than getting a feel for the situation.
Absolutely. I think it gives you a better understanding of people's experiences as well, Paul, because you can put yourself in their shoes and look at the environment, and it changes depending on what time of year you go as well, you know what I mean?
It really does, yeah.
These are things that can happen. So, Paul, I think I've kept you long enough with everything that's going on. Where can everybody get hold of Wolflands, follow your work, watch the Truthproof live streams, and just keep up to date with everything you've got going on at the minute, my friend?
Yeah, well, Wolflands is available on Amazon Prime. I don't know the mechanics of Amazon Prime, if I'm being truthful, at the moment. I think it's running at about number 25 at the moment in documentaries, which is, we're happy. You know, that's good. Yes, we will have DVDs for sale after the Awakening conference. So that's going to be after the 28th of this month. And we'll get a link onto the truthproof.uk website. And we'll have a link where people can obtain the DVDs, should you wish to buy one. We should also have some Blu-rays as well. And I've heard a lot of people saying there's no market for DVDs, but I'm getting people asking me all the time if they can obtain a copy of Bringing Down the Light. And I think Chris Turner still gets asked for Elusive quite a lot. So there is a market out there for DVDs, so we will be putting them out there. As regards the Truthproof books, Paul, the paperbacks are available through the website, truthproof.uk, plus on Amazon. Anybody visiting area, contact me. I'm same as everybody else. Everybody's as good as everybody else in my eyes. You can knock on my door and you can obtain the books there if you want to. And the actual Kindle books, obviously, Amazon. The non-physical books can be obtained from Amazon. So, yeah, absolutely. That's where we're at with it, Paul.
Fabulous. Well, I wish you the very best of luck. Like I say, I watched it within minutes of you guys finishing your announcement live stream. Absolutely loved it. All power to everybody involved in it, yourself, Les, Nick and Jess, and everybody else that's worked tirelessly for the last 3 years to bring this forwards. I wish you the very best of luck. It's highly, highly reviewed already. I've just had a quick look. You've got 35, Paul. I think you're at 4.6 out of 5, which is some damn good going for a review for something out so early, mate.
Oh, that's good. 4.6. So maybe there's a negative review there, because I think you were a little bit better than that, but can't please everybody, can you?
No, of course not. But I think you've done a sterling job. You've presented people's stories firsthand. You've allowed them to tell your tale. You've not twisted them. You've not put it forward as some other kind of you've not decided what they're experiencing. You've just told us these stories. It's brilliant. I'm chuffed to bits for everybody that's involved in it, Paul, because I know exactly how much hard work you've done. So I wish you the very, very best of luck. And if hopefully we'll meet up in person, because I know, like I say, you're doing the Awakenings conference coming up this month as well.
Yeah, that's correct.
In Manchester. So, yeah, you'll be looking forward to September and put your feet up for a couple of days, mate, at least. Well, try to.
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, I were on them clifftops last night till 12:30, and I plan to go again tonight. So I must want to, I don't know, I don't need to give my head a good shake, don't I?
Hey, it's good to be out in fresh air, mate.
Do you know what, Paul and people, it stops me nibbling, because if I'm sat in house, I might just eat these biscuits, crisps, chocolate, it stops me nibbling. Oh, that's good.
Well, as always, Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time, because I know you're so busy at the minute with everything going on with the film's release. So thank you as always.
You're welcome, Paul. You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.